So we come this week to the second chapter in the Life Divine, which is titled The Two Negations. One, the materialist denial. When we talked about the first chapter, the human aspiration, and we looked at it in the original aria, there was a subtitle, The Affirmations of Vedanta. And now we find that he has, almost at the outset, to deal with not affirmations, but with the denials of modern or even ancient philosophy. So let's go through this with some care. If you will permit me, we're going to proceed line by line. The first motto from Anupanishad opens this chapter. He energized conscious force in the austerity of thought and came to the knowledge that matter is the Brahman. For from matter, all existences are born. Born, by matter they increase and enter into matter in their passing hence. Then he went to Varuna, his father, and said, Lord, teach me of the Brahman. But he said to him, energize again the conscious energy in you, in thee. For the energy is Brahman. This is from the Taittiriya Upanishad. This is an old story, one of the great stories of Upanishadic literature. Bhrigu is the head of a line of rishis. His father, Varuna, the name, by the way, means vast, like the ocean, attends upon his son's questions. And to summarize it, the son has come of an age and of a maturity of insight where he wants to know the truth behind the world. And so his father, in a sense, challenges him and says, go inside yourself, practice tapasya, this deep energizing of consciousness, and in that focus, dwell upon what is real, and what is it that gives birth to things, what sustains things, and what dissolves things. And so, this very first formulation is Brahman is anam, is food, is matter. He discovers this, but comes back to his father again and says, Father, teach me of Brahman. And he says, go and practice eskesis, this tapas, this tapasya, because Brahman is tapasya. If you want to know it, you have to practice it. So again, he goes inside himself and he discovers that it is not matter, but it is life which is the foundation of all things, from which all things draw their energy and into which all things pass. But again, he's not satisfied. He goes again to his father, asks the same question, gets the same challenge, and looks more deeply still and finds that it is mind that has given rise to all of this. It is mind's conception that sustains things, and into mind all things pass. But again, he has this feeling, this is not all. And his father again says, practice. And again, he challenges himself, and he comes back and says, vijnana, what Sri Aurobindo calls supermind. That is the thing which is the beginning of all things, the continuation of all things, and the dissolution of all things. He comes back to his father a last time, and he says, "Father, teach me of Brahman." And his father says, "Go, practice." A wonderful teaching, though. Mm-hmm. And so in this, he finally comes back, and he says, "It is ananda, it is bliss, it is delight, which is the birth of all things, their sustainment. And into bliss, all things pass in their going hence." And then Bhrigu was satisfied. He didn't sink farther. But all these existences are real. But the first, you see, is also Brahman. Matter, that from which food comes to us, is verily the truth, the eternal, the real. And Sri Aurobindo cites this at the very opening of this chapter. And this, again, is an affirmation. So, he writes, "The affirmation of a divine life upon earth and an immortal sense in mortal existence can have no base unless we recognize not only eternal spirit as the inhabitant of this bodily mansion, the wearer of this mutable robe, but accept matter of which it is made as a fit and noble material out of which he weaves constantly his garbs, builds recurrently the unending series of his mansions." He has not cited yet the Isha Upanishad, which you'll remember he wrote a long commentary on before the Arya ever came into being, and he had titled that commentary The Life Divine. But here, in this first paragraph, we have the first verse of the Isha Upanishad. "All this is for habitation by the Lord. Whatsoever is individual universe of movement in the universal motion, by that renounced you should enjoy. Lust not after any man's possession." So the divine lives inside this world as if this world is its garb, and constantly this fit and noble material is changing as he builds, as he says, recurrently the unending series of his mansions. So the Isha Upanishad actually won't be cited until the fifth chapter of The Life Divine. But already it forms the basis, visibly the basis, of what he's writing about. So let's go now to the second paragraph. "Nor is this even enough to guard us against a recoil from life in the body, unless with the Upanishads, perceiving behind their appearances the identity and essence of these two extreme terms of existence, we are able to say, in the very language of those ancient writings, matter also is Brahman, and to give its full value to the vigorous figure by which the physical universe is described as the external body of the divine being. Nor, so far divided apparently are these two extreme terms, is that identification convincing to the rational intellect if we refuse to recognize a series of ascending terms, life, mind, supermind, and the grades that link mind to supermind, between spirit and matter. Otherwise, the two must appear as irreconcilable opponents bound together in an unhappy wedlock, and their divorce the one reasonable solution. To identify them, to represent each in the terms of the other becomes an artificial creation of thought opposed to the logic of facts and possible only by an irrational mysticism. So the two terms that are at polar opposites are the spirit above and matter below. There is a phrase you see in parentheses in the middle of that paragraph, life, mind, supermind, and the grades that link mind to supermind. That's the first alteration Sri Aurobindo has made in what originally appeared in the Arya. This was inserted later, because it wasn't clear what these linking realities were in the chain of being if he didn't put them there, because they hadn't been expressed before. So we have at the base matter, and then life, and then mind, and then supermind, leading into what is spirit. So by connotation, spirit means Brahman, or what we'll come to term Satchit Ananda later. So Sri Aurobindo is stating that in the largest enterprise of the conscious spirit, we cannot afford to lose either of these. They must be part of one view to have real value to us in terms of an integrated life. You'll see that Sri Aurobindo is capitalizing some of these nouns. You know, that was a habit that was prevalent in English up until really early in the 20th century. So it may seem antiquated, it's a holdover from previous ages. But to stick with how Sri Aurobindo wrote it, I think is wise, and we can make the adjustment. Also in those decades, long before we have come, I think, to a wiser view, it was common in speaking of social life or the larger figure of humanity to refer to humanity as mankind. There is no gender bias in Sri Aurobindo except in the fact that he was using the language of that time, that women could be left out in the use of that term is unfortunate, because having a single syllable to express everything about the human species is handy. Unfortunately, there is a masculine bias in it. But you'll find that Sri Aurobindo uses these terms frequently throughout. I hope no one takes offense by it. Certainly, Sri Aurobindo, who was the greatest devotee of the Divine Mother, meant none. So again, the large point here is that the physical universe is, in a sense, the external body of the divine. And the spirit at the top of the chain of being must be synthesized, if I can use that verb, with materiality to have an answer that will ultimately satisfy humanity. So to that sense we turn next in the third paragraph. If we assert only pure spirit and a mechanical, unintelligent substance or energy, and let me break off here and say that again, we're back to the Sankhya philosophy and the division between the Purusha, we can refer to that as the spirit here, and Prakriti, which would be the mechanical, unintelligent substance or energy, calling one God or soul and the other nature, the inevitable end will be that we shall either deny God or else turn from nature. That is the problem with the dualistic philosophy of the Sankhya. It's the problem that arises in modern European philosophy as well. Cartesian dualism uses much this same technique in describing the inner subjectivity as versus the outer play of nature. So if there is that division, how do you unify it? You're forced into one corner or the other. You're either going to support spirit or you're going to support matter. You're going to say Purusha is real and Prakriti should be pushed away, or vice versa. So he continues, for both thought and life, a choice then becomes imperative. Remember, at the base is matter, at the top is spirit. Life and thought are in the middle. They're middle terms of existence. They're not the beginning of things. They can't find the beginning of the world in either of these forces. Life comes out of matter. And to our experience, mind comes out of life. I might also pause for a moment and say that the way Sri Aurobindo is beginning to set up this dialectic is referring to what would be 19th and early 20th century philosophy. So when he's representing thought, you might be thinking in the back of your mind, ah, so he's talking about Berkeley and Hume and Locke and Schopenhauer and Hegel. And when he's talking about life, clearly he would be referring to Henri Bergson, who wrote this book on creative evolution, presenting life as the fundamental force of the development of the world. So there's a little background here which, you know, folds into this. Thought, back to the text here, thought comes to deny the one as an illusion of the imagination, that would be matter, or the other as an illusion of the senses, and that would be spirit. One view contradicting the other. Life comes to fix on the immaterial and flee from itself in a disgust or a self-forgetting ecstasy, or else to deny its own immortality and take its orientation away from God and towards the animal. So to flee into the immaterial means to abandon the world altogether, and life resolves into its principle of immortality and it's back in its superphysical station. Or it renounces its immortality and assigns itself simply to the cabin of animality and then Purusha and Prakriti, the passively luminous soul of the Samkhyas and their mechanically active energy, have nothing in common, not even their opposite modes of inertia. Their antinomies can only be resolved by the cessation of the inertly driven activity into the immutable repose upon which it has been casting in vain the sterile procession of its images. Now that's a very good description of what happens when Purusha refuses to look any longer at Prakriti, and Prakriti just falls into an equilibrium. Not getting the glance of Purusha means that it has no reason to move. Nature stops. Purusha, absorbed in itself, takes no notice of Prakriti. So both become inert. This is no answer for life. And then Sri Aurobindo continues, Shankara's wordless, inactive self and his Maya of many names and forms are equally disparate and irreconcilable entities. Their rigid antagonism can terminate only by the dissolution of the multitudinous illusion into the sole truth of an eternal silence. Now this is practically true. Shankara is aiming at a kind of monism, but he does it by denying the other pole of existence. All that seems to be moving, this phantasmagorial universe, is an illusion. It isn't real. And what is real is the steady, unmoving Brahman. Now, we've spent some months looking at the Sankhya philosophy as it appears again and again. Its terminology coheres throughout Indian thought all the way up until today. And we know what Shankara's perspective has meant to the development of philosophic thought in India. There is still this kind of practical dualism, this divide between self and world. So we still don't have a functioning, unitary view of things. It's as if the human mind, by the investiture of its language, brings into being a fundamental dualism, that it sees things in distinction, not in unity. But I anticipate, don't I? So Sri Aurobindo says, the materialist has an easier field. It is possible for him, by denying spirit, to arrive at a more readily convincing simplicity of statement, a real monism, a monism of matter, or else of force. But in this rigidity of statement, it is impossible for him to persist permanently. He too ends by positing an unknowable, as inert, as remote from the known universe as the passive Purusha or the silent Atman. It serves no purpose but to put off by a vague concession the inexorable demands of thought, or to stand as an excuse for refusing to extend the limits of inquiry. So what he's saying essentially is that the materialist, by the definition of the terms that he's using, can't rest in that monism, because he's always driven by the very force of the inquiry to proceed beyond the known to the unknown, and therefore outstrips the realm of materiality. He arrives into the borderlands where he meets things that can't be explained. Again, this is just an adumbration from Sri Aurobindo here. We'll get deeper into these arguments as we go through the chapter. But he's giving us hints. And you've also seen hints so far of a number of things that will appear throughout the book. The idea of this great chain of being, with the supermind playing an important link, of the Sankhya terminology, of the role of this driving force to unification, what purpose it has in the world, how it can't rest. These things will be themes that we'll never quit looking at. They'll be with us all the way through the 1100 or so pages of The Life Divine. And we're only on page 7 in this version. Therefore, in these barren contradictions, the human mind cannot rest satisfied. It must seek always a complete affirmation. It can find it only by a luminous reconciliation. To reach that reconciliation, it must traverse the degrees which our inner consciousness imposes on us. And whether by objective method of analysis applied to life and mind as to matter, or by subjective synthesis and illumination, arrive at the repose of the ultimate unity without denying the energy of the expressive multiplicity. This idea of a oneness in diversity, of a unity and multiplicity, each within the other, is core to his view. We have seen that in the foundations of his spiritual life, in those two great realizations that he had. And his hint here that the objective analysis can be coupled with, or in a sense partnered with, a subjective synthesis, which is based on an inner awakening, is important, because it may be that we can affirm these greater realities with an inner science more rapidly and more potently than we can with the brute machinery that we've come to associate with mechanical sciences. He continues, only in such a complete and catholic illumination can all the multiform and apparently contradictory data of existence be harmonized and the manifold conflicting forces which govern our thought and life discover the central truth which they are here to symbolize and variously fulfill. So he's in a sense given us a hint of what is the purpose of the universe in this sentence. Whatever that is, it is trying to work out through forms which symbolize itself its own fulfillment, but not singularly, but multiply. There may be an overall cosmic will which is working out a general aim, but also it is working microscopically in threads of connection, too numerous to count. And through all of this, it is the dynamism of one being seeking itself in many forms. So the idea, which we'll come to again in just a few paragraphs, that everything here is a symbol of that, means that everything here has an implied value in it. There is nothing, whether it is material or vital or mental, it is an emotion, it is a thing, it is a thought, that does not have value and does not reveal some aspect of the all-sustaining divinity behind it. All-sustaining because that reality that supports that particular unique movement is also supporting everything else at one and the same time. Then only can our thought, having attained a true center, ceasing to wander in circles, work like the Brahman of the Upanishad, fixed and stable even in its play and its worldwide coursing, and our life, knowing its aim, serve it with a serene and settled joy and light, as well as with a rhythmically discursive energy. And this is a reading of the fourth and fifth verse of the Isha Upanishad. See if I can find it. I'll read that to you. One unmoving that is swifter than mind, that the gods reach not, for it progresses ever in front, that standing passes beyond others as they run, in that the master of life establishes the waters, that moves and that moves not, that is far and the same is near, that is within all this and that also is outside all this. So again, you see how powerfully present the Isha Upanishad is. Even when it's not overtly cited, it's still fashioning almost the language which Sri Aurobindo is using. So, still with me? Can we go a little farther? Next paragraph, then. But when that rhythm has once been disturbed, it is necessary and helpful that man should test separately in their extreme assertion each of the two great opposites. In other words, if you have affirmed that both spirit and matter are real, and that rests with you well, And the age is rolling along, and this seems to be the overarching harmony that carries the culture forward. Maybe things change, and then that harmony is lost. That rhythm has been disturbed. When that happens, let's look at those two extremes again and see where they take us. Because if we don't, we don't get to that reconciliation, right? We have to achieve that reconciliation. So if we've broken it, we have to rebuild it. And we can only rebuild it from within, from a long, intensive process. We have to do that tapasya. I'm back to Sri Aurobindo here. It is the mind's natural way of returning more perfectly to the affirmation it has lost. On the road, it may attempt to rest in the intervening degrees, reducing all things into the terms of an original life energy, or of sensation, or of ideas. But these exclusive solutions have always an air of unreality. They may satisfy, for a time, the logical reason which deals only with pure ideas, but they cannot satisfy the mind's sense of actuality. So we can posit that matter only exists, or we can posit that only the mind's view of things is real, and matter is simply an illusion dancing in front of us. Pay no attention to it, it goes away. But life as a whole, humanity as a whole, knows better. They're both cheats. They're both lying. For the mind knows that there is something behind itself which is not the idea. So the mind is a kind of consciousness. And it works, it moves from moment to moment through the process of ideation. But what is consciousness in itself, of which mind is the outer movement? Mind has a sense that there's something behind it. It knows, on the other hand, that there is something within itself which is more than the vital breath. Just so, the life force is not the Atman. The life force, like the mind, is an expression of the power of conscious being, but it's not the whole of it. So what is that thing? What is that thing which is behind the thinking, behind the living? What is that being? Either spirit or matter can give it, for a time, some sense of ultimate reality. Not so any of the principles that intervene. So we won't find the answer in the power of life. We won't find the answer in the power of mind. It must therefore go to the two extremes before it can return fruitfully upon the whole. For by its very nature, served by a sense that can perceive with distinctness only the parts of existence, and by a speech that also can achieve distinctness only when it carefully divides and limits, the intellect is driven, having before it this multiplicity of elemental principles, to seek unity by reducing all ruthlessly to the terms of one. So the senses can perceive only a bit, only parts. And the speech, which represents the mind, names, draws forms, which always limits and divides, draws distinctions. And so it's not a power of unification, but it's a power of division. It draws contrasts. You are you, and I am me. This and that. I and thou. And so there's a limitation. The senses reach out, and there's all this world, and it reaches out, and look how much of the floor it grabs. And it thinks it knows everything. I know the floor. Well, it has an aspect. It has touched the floor. Does it have it?
Mm.
It attempts, practically, Sri Aurobindo writes, in order to assert this one, to get rid of the others, to perceive the real source of their identity. Without this exclusive process, it must either have overleaped itself or must have completed the circuit only to find that all equally reduce themselves to that which escapes definition or description and is yet not only real but attainable. By whatever road we may travel, that is always the end at which we arrive, and we can only escape it by refusing to complete the journey. So, that one. In the Rig Veda, you'll remember it was called Tad Ekam. That. You can't say. Is it impersonal? Is it personal? Ungraspable to the senses, unknowable to the mind, but that exists. And if you haven't got to that, then you really have not got to that. It is therefore of good augury that after many experiments and verbal solutions, we should now find ourselves standing today in the presence of the two that have alone borne for long the most rigorous tests of experience, the two extremes, and that at the end of the experience, both should have come to a result which the universal instinct in mankind, that veiled judge, sentinel, and representative of the universal spirit of truth, refuses to accept as right or as satisfying. In Europe and in India, respectively, the negation of the materialist and the refusal of the ascetic have sought to assert themselves as the sole truth and to dominate the conception of life. In India, if the result has been a great heaping up of the treasures of the spirit, or of some of them, it has also been a great bankruptcy of life. In Europe, the fullness of riches and the triumphant mastery of this world's powers and possessions have progressed towards an equal bankruptcy in the things of the spirit. Nor has the intellect, which sought the solution of all problems in the one term of matter, found satisfaction in the answer that it has received. So, this was the view in the early 20th century that India, which had begun with the Vedantic affirmations that all this is Brahman, had by then gone through the long train of Buddhistic and Mayavadin thought and arrived at a dismissal or a disavowal of the powers of life. And in that choice, had in a sense forfeited the fullness of life. Once the richest and one of the mightiest countries on earth had begun to be subjugated by Muslim invasion, by British invasion. And it was only then, at this point, that Sri Aurobindo began to reassert that India should be great again, that this perspective of spirituality should embrace material things, vital things, as well as mental things, led to a kind of renaissance in his motherland. And it is also true that about this time in Europe, after the Age of Enlightenment, and isn't it ironic to us how Europeans have referred to Enlightenment as sheer rationalism, when by Enlightenment we would refer to the spiritual illumination that lights everything up. That Age of Enlightenment, which led to great scientific breakthroughs, failed ultimately to satisfy. The spirit of perfectionism, which dominated 19th century thinking, was already beginning to collapse. We see, as Sri Aurobindo is writing these words, the Great War was opening up in Europe. We see two or three decades earlier that Europe, dissatisfied with the paltry leavings of materialism, which offered no real significance to life, began to turn again to some spiritual meaning through the offices of the Theosophical Society, led by Blavatsky and others, to affirm the power of the subjective. And even in that crude beginning, a question hung over Europe. If matter is all, what next? If it is not all, how do we get to it? Is there a spirit, and can we know it? And so spiritualism, theosophy, a lot of brands of occultism, of conscious inquiry, began to open up in Europe. And this is part of the backdrop against which Sri Aurobindo is writing these opening chapters of The Life Divine. Continuing then, therefore, the time grows ripe, and the tendency of the world moves towards a new and comprehensive affirmation in thought and in inner and outer experience, and to its corollary, a new and rich self-fulfillment in an integral human existence for the individual and the race. So another key point for Sri Aurobindo is that the inner illumination, the affirmation of the powers of life that he seeks, that he asserts are real, is not limited to the individual, but must include the general, the communal, the collective. A collective realization is possible. A harmonization of life such that it incorporates mankind into this greater power of illumination and lifts it up so that it can become a conscious representative multiply of the emerging spirit without losing its base in matter. I think I need to get a test of will here and see if you're ready to go through the rest of the chapter. We're only roughly halfway through it. Do you want to pick it up next week, or shall we plunge in?
Next week.
Next week. Aren't you glad I asked? I'm glad I asked. All right, then I think that is a good place to put our mark. Do you have questions about these first few paragraphs of this second chapter? Yes.
Question I have is, you know, Sri Aurobindo's theory of evolution from matter to life to mind, and then further on supermind. In the beginning sentence, he says that's nature's intent. The intent of nature, and he capitalized nature in the custom that there was, as you indicate. So my question is, you know, when I think of nature, I think of automaton, you know, a force and energy without any kind of a will.
Right.
It's a blind force.
Right, that's the Sankhian view of things, yes.
But that's not what he means by nature.
Absolutely not, no. No. In fact, to go back to the issue of Upanishad in its opening verse, all this is the habitation of the divine. There is nothing that is not divine in essence. Even matter is not the inert automaton that Sankhyan philosophy would have it to be. It is not simple mechanical energy. It is conscious in its own right. Sri Aurobindo's experience, not simply his philosophic view, but his experience is that matter has instinctive within it all these powers of consciousness, that within matter is life, is mind, is a secret supermind. So it's not dumb. It is, in a sense, sublimely asleep and has to be awakened. What awakens it? The pressure of higher grades of consciousness pressing from above. But we'll get to that when we enter into his discussion of evolution and what is the process of that. What are the powers that make matter evolve upon Earth? So we'll get to that. You know, we're dealing with the denials here, but early on he will look at the power of matter, the power of life, etc.
I just had a thought about the feminine aspects of nature, making nature feminine and masculine. And in Western thought, often when they're burned as witches or they're terrified of the occult and esteem rational thought, that was just a thought.
Yes. The idea that the power of nature is conscious being is part of that tantric synthesis that Sri Aurobindo will address in the synthesis of yoga. You know, as with the first chapter on the human aspiration, which opened the Life Divine series, the last phrase that closes the first essay on synthesis of yoga is all life is yoga. So there's this idea of oneness that is ringing out throughout his view, because his experience is that this power, this Shakti, doesn't simply exist above, superconscient to us, but is present in all things, seeking its expression, its fulfillment, its divine delight. And so if it takes it the course of a universe to achieve it, then that's fine for that conscious willpower, which is Mahashakti. It is not simply feminine to draw these things into the rigid idea that one is masculine and the other feminine is an oversimplification, because both polarities of being are in all of us regardless of our gender. And we come to the happiest of harmonies when we recognize it within ourselves and give manifestation to the power and be at once the authorizing, sanctioning Anumanta and the active dynamizing Shakti, which carries out the willpower. Thank you for your question.
Back to Ludden's question, isn't it also in the first chapter where he talks about nature delivering up man, and then man ultimately delivering up the manifestation of God? So the nature to do that had to be a swirling will of processes to produce man from its matter.
Yes.
So it's not inert. It's not a purposeless automaton kind of thing. It had a role then and a role now.
Yes. There's a cosmic will trying to work itself out, which is larger than any human view can understand. And he will deal with that also, with the idea of why does there seem to be evil in the world? That's when we get to the delight of existence, the problem and the solution, many chapters from now. Yeah. Well, we're up to roughly page 9.
Yeah.
Not quite a percent through the book. Any other questions this evening? So these are fairly simple and easy chapters. I'm giving a little background as we go just to sort of set the table. The real work begins later, and I would expect that if we do several pages a night, 5-6 pages a night, it's going to be good work. It'll be a good evening. There may be times where there's a lot to say and we'll only turn a page or two. So don't judge the success of the evening, I think, by whether we get to open and close a chapter in one night. It's only the first few chapters, which are relatively short. I think it's more important for us to take our time and appreciate the richness of what Sri Aurobindo has invested in this, and to draw it out. So then we'll go for our meditation. Jai Ma. Namaste.